One of the main objectives of our Update audio programs is to provide listeners with a variety of perspectives on similar topics, and particularly new data sets with practice-changing implications like the FLEX study. And so we go to our next interview with Dr. Rogerio Lilienbaum, who began by confessing that, like many clinical investigators, he's still pondering the clinical implications of the intriguing FLEX data set.
I am still trying to digest this information and trying to decide how to apply this to clinical practice. And I believe that most of my colleagues are in the same position. I think intuitively, you would think perhaps patients who are not being treated with bevacizumab as another monoclonal antibody may then be candidates for chemo plus cetuximab. I think that may be the case, and I suspect that that's how the drug will be used, at least in the beginning. It's not what the study is about, really, since the study involves every patient. You know, they're...
Or those with one cell that's IHC.
Exactly. EGFR. But patients that are potentially eligible for bevacizumab as well.
Right. But just to pick up on that point, though, about the EGFR, because technically it was part of the criteria. Mm-hmm. Do you think that for practical purposes that test should be obtained?
I think in light of the other study, the other phase 3 study, which did not have the same requirement.
And that was
Tom's study, the BMS-099 study, and had negative results. I think we probably should look at EGFR protein expression by IHC, which is a relatively simple test, and it's been available for quite some time, you know, before we offer cetuximab to patients. Perhaps another level moving forward would be KRAS mutations, and that was another interesting presentation at ASCO in colorectal cancer. Whether that applies also to non-small cell lung cancer, I think, remains to be seen. If it does, it will be quite interesting.
While you're bringing that up, what do we know about KRAS and non-small cell?
Well, it's an adverse prognostic feature. It's expressed in approximately 20 to 30% of patients, predominantly adenocarcinoma patients, but not exclusively. And it appears to be an important negative predictor of response to EGFR TKIs, at least in non-small cell lung cancer. But we don't know about EGFR monoclonal antibodies yet in that setting. I think the data in colorectal cancer was very compelling. And in colorectal cancer, if I understood the numbers, we're talking about 40% of patients who may not benefit from that agent at all. So if we have a similar predictor in non-small cell lung cancer, I think that would be important. But until that happens, I would stick to EGFR protein expression because that may very well be the most significant distinction between the FLEX study and the BMS-099 trial.
Focusing on the one group that you started with, which would be people who would not be eligible for Bev. So let's say somebody with hemoptysis or poor performance status, squamous cell would be the most common one. I mean, what have you been doing? I don't know. Maybe with reimbursement, it's not even an issue yet, is it? Is that the case?
No, I have not proposed that to a patient yet. So I haven't tested the system, so to speak, you know, as far as being able to obtain the drug. As I said a few minutes ago, I haven't really decided, you know, how to bring that into my practice. So the patients that I have seen since ASCO that are eligible for first-line chemo, I have not offered cetuximab yet.
And just thinking through the risk-benefit issues without the reimbursement right now, how does it look to you? Let's say squamous cell.
I think it's a difficult decision, but I think for a patient who otherwise would be treated with combination chemotherapy alone, it would not be unreasonable to discuss the addition of cetuximab. There's a cost, however, involved, not necessarily from a financial standpoint, but a cost to the patient in terms of toxicity. And there were some toxicities that appear more pronounced in the cetuximab arm. And also inconvenience, because as in the bevacizumab trial, there's a maintenance cetuximab following the initial 6 cycles of chemo in that case. And that's not easy. That's weekly. And some of the side effects may be annoying, to say the least, to some patients.
And most people don't have experience with cetuximab in non-small cell, but you do because you've been involved with trials. And is it pretty much what you see in colon, or because the patients are different, older, more comorbidities, does the toxicity play out any differently?
I'm not sure if there are significant differences in the toxicity profile in non-small cell lung cancer patients versus colorectal patients. I was impressed by the frequency and the severity of the rash, which to me appeared more pronounced than what we typically see with tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
Yeah, it's really hard to get a feel for that. Some people you ask about the rash and they say, really, this is not a big deal. For most patients, occasionally it is. But I don't know. Do we have numbers on it? Is it more anecdotal in terms of, you know, what fraction of people after, you know, a month or two go, you know, this is really not good?
I don't know the exact data for flax as far as discontinuation because of skin toxicity. I suspect that it will be low, just like it was for erlotinib, for example, it clearly in the single digits.
So, I mean, for example, if a patient were to say to you, I know we don't have data on thousands of people, but what's your best estimate based on your experience? What's the chance I'm really not going to have any problem? What's the chance I'm going to have a problem that's going to really bother me? What's, you know, how would you sort of break out that demographically in your own experience?
I would say that probably 20% of patients may not have a skin rash at all. I would say that probably up to 20% of patients then may have severe rash to the point that it will mandate either, you know, a temporary discontinuation of the drug or a dose adjustment, and then everybody else, you know, will be in between.
And is the issue more cosmetic symptoms or both?
Both. For some patients, especially after the initial couple of months, it becomes cosmetic. But the beginning is not easy. And you see that with the TKIs as well. I mean, there's a certain degree of inflammation and dryness associated with the rash.
It is kind of hard to kind of compare things. I kind of get the feeling that maybe in some ways it is more difficult in the TKIs.
I would say so.
And any other side effects or toxicities that will be in your mind as you think this thing through? Is it the skin mainly?
I think the skin in the FLEX study in particular, which I had not appreciated in previous studies, there was also a higher incidence of neutropenia on the cetuximab, which was sort of interesting. And I didn't think he had major clinical implications, but the numbers were different between the two arms. But mainly skin rash, you know, perhaps I don't think diarrhea is a major issue with this drug.
When you think about the benefit side of the equation of chemo plus Bev versus chemo plus cetuximab, obviously it's an indirect comparison. But when you start to make those comparison, does it look similar, ballpark? One better than the other? How does it sort of look for you?
I actually have a slide that I sometimes present exactly showing the results of the FLAX with results of 4599. And the main point I have about that slide is that we shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
You know, because, again, these are, you know, very different trials, different patient populations, you know, conducted in different places. So I think the caveats in this type of comparison are pretty significant. Having said that, you know, we sometimes can't resist the temptation. So I think it's another issue we haven't discussed about the flags that is an important point of distinction, you know, with 4599 is the lack of advantage in progression-free survival. Exactly the same in the two arms. While, you know, you saw a two-month difference in progression-free survival in the 4599 trial. And that, again, remains to be explained. And then the difference in overall survival, again, is approximately 1 month in the FLEX trial, and it was 2 months in the 4599 trial. You include the Asian population, which didn't really exist, you know, wasn't a prominent part of 4599. You take them away, it becomes closer. It's a very difficult, you know, sort of fragmented comparison. So it's hard to tell that one agent is superior to the other agent at this time. I don't think we can really do that. Now, that discussion is compounded by the AVEO result.
Can you go through that?
The AVEO was the European trial that looked at chemo with or without bevacizumab in two different doses. And the chemo backbone in that study was cis gemcitabine. And the doses were 7.5 mg per kg and 15 mg per kg, which was the American trial. So that study was initially released and presented as showing a statistically significant difference in progression-free survival, which was the main endpoint of the study. The study went through several changes, but at the end it became a progression-free survival trial. And even though the median PFS, you know, in the three arms really were not that different, the curves did split a bit at the end, and that was statistically significant with a hazard ratio that wasn't as positive as the hazard ratio for 45-99. What we know about the AVEO trial now is a press release indicating that there was no difference in overall survival. And we haven't seen the data yet. We were hoping to see it at ASCO, and I think we'll have to wait until the fall for the European meeting when the final results will be presented. I don't know how people will interpret those results either. If you want to be a purist, you can say this is a progression-free survival trial. It met the endpoint. It's a positive study, and it's sort of adds or confirms what we saw in 45-99, case closed. But there are nuances to that interpretation. You know, one, again, is the magnitude of the difference in progression-free survival, and second, the fact that there was really no difference at all in the overall survival. I don't know what that means from a clinical standpoint and whether people will change their practice with respect to bevacizumab. I suspect that not in the United States, but I believe there may be changes outside of the United States based on the AVEO trial.
In terms of whether to use Bev or the dose?
Whether to use.
How about the dose?
I think if people choose to use bevacizumab outside of the United States, they most likely will use the 7.5 mg per kg.
How about in the U.S.?
I think people will, by and large, stick to the 15 milligrams per kilogram, but I think once in a while we may use, you know, 7.5. And I don't know what that means from a regulatory standpoint. You know, regulatory agencies may take a veil and say, you know, we don't think the benefit is there and the drug may not be approved outside of the United States. I don't know that. And so the whole picture as far as bevacizumab may change. And so when you talk about bevacizumab and cetuximab, it's a much more complicated scenario landscape than it was 6 or 12 months ago.
One of the things that people balance out is their own clinical experience. And of course, now docs have had a lot more time to utilize Bev in non-small cell, you know, particularly dealing with the issue of hemoptysis and pulmonary hemorrhage and some of the other issues. How is that sort of playing out now in your practice now that things have sort of settled down and you kind of figured out how to do this?
I have a sense that people are, as you just said, much more comfortable with the drug, much more. They use it in non-small cell lung cancer. They use it in colorectal cancer. They use it in breast cancer now. So people are aware of the pulmonary hemorrhage issue, but it doesn't seem to be an impediment the way it was when ECOG 4599 was first presented. And you could tell some doctors wanted just to be distanced from bevacizumab. I don't sense that anymore.
And how has that actually played out? You know, we're trying to explore what kinds of patients are at higher risk for this. Have we learned anything more about that?
I don't think we have any new information on this issue.
What about this issue of cavitation, either before or during treatment?
So in the limited analysis that the 4599 authors were able to present at ASCO, there was a trend towards a higher rate of pulmonary hemorrhage for people with cavitation, but it wasn't statistically significant. We were dealing with very small numbers overall. I think there's a concern in that respect, but I don't know that we can say that people who go on this agent and develop cavitation within the tumor should not receive it anymore. I think other issues have happened with bevacizumab. For example, we now have, I think, pretty solid data that this drug can be used in patients with brain metastases after they receive definitive treatment for CNS metastases and are stable from a neurological standpoint. I find that a pretty significant step forward because we were excluding a good chunk of patients from bevacizumab. I think we will also gain some level of comfort with anticoagulation pretty soon. AVEO was already different
right
in that respect than 4599. So
yeah, can you review that in terms of AVEO versus 4599?
So the main difference was people who had a thromboembolic phenomena within 6 months of enrollment still were not eligible for AVAIL. But if they developed one of these complications while on bevacizumab, they were allowed to continue with full anticoagulation. And these individuals did not have a significantly higher rate of pulmonary hemorrhage or bleeding complications. That's important. And I have already seen in my practice patients of mine and also patients that I have seen in second opinion that doctors did not stop the bevacizumab in the setting of a DVT, for example, or other thromboembolic disease.
What about arterial events?
In my practice, that would, to me, mean that I had to discontinue the drug. So I have not encountered that from other doctors.
Where do you think things are heading from a research perspective? And one issue, and this is coming up in colon cancer too, is, you know, the question of Bev plus cetuximab.
Yeah, I was going to address that as well. So there's a SWOG proposal on the table trying to look at the two monoclonal antibodies in combination. That study has undergone several reviews within the NCI. It may be approved. It will take a while for that study to be activated and certainly to complete enrollment. But there is a certain concern based on the data that is available for colorectal cancer. I believe there are two trials.
Yep, Cairo was just presented.
Exactly, Cairo was just presented showing a potential detriment.
Right, so we've
seen the two antibodies. Exactly.
So we've seen this with panitumumab as well as cetuximab.
Exactly.
Not very exciting results.
Yes, so I don't know how that will influence the SWOG proposal or what the NCI is going to do, but that's an issue because that would be the next logical step moving forward in non-small cell lung cancer. I also think that another important research question regarding cetuximab is molecular predictors. So we talked a little bit about just EGFR protein expression, and then we talked a little bit about KRAS as a negative predictor. What we haven't discussed is FISH. So if you look at the phase 2 study from SWOG, I believe it was 0342, that looked at chemo with bevacizumab in two different sequences, you know, concomitant or sequential. That study incorporated an analysis by FISH. And even though both arms had, I would say, expected results as far as progression-free survival and median survival times, when they broke down the data by FISH positive and FISH negative, it was quite remarkable what they saw. Progression-free survival doubled in FISH positive patients compared to FISH negative. It was 3 versus 6 months. And I think the median survival also doubled, 7 to nearly 15 months, FISH negative versus FISH positive. So this may very well be an important niche for cetuximab moving forward, and perhaps more so than FISH in terms of EGFR TKIs. So it goes back to what we were discussing, you know, who really benefits from this agent. So FISH is looking very promising as a potential predictor. So that is incorporated in the phase 3 SWOG proposal as well.
I know you're participating in the ECOG adjuvant study, and these are CIS-based regimens. How's that going in terms of putting patients on, how people respond to it?
We have, I believe, 5 patients on the study, and we've had no major issues so far as far as complications. Most interestingly, I think only one of those 5 patients was actually randomized to bevacizumab. So we haven't had to deal with the maintenance yet. So as far as the chemo, we've had no major problems.
Now, that study allows either docetaxel, vinorelbine, or gem with the CIS. What are you generally doing?
I use either docetaxel or gemcitabine in combination with cisplatin. And I have to say, I'm surprised by how many lung cancer investigators and institutions have adopted the cis-vinorelbine combination. I can understand why, because that's where the data is in terms of the international adjuvant trials. I find cis-vinorelbine at least an inconvenient regimen, and I can't see how it is offering any advantage over the other two regimens. If you take the stage 4 data, you know, cis-docetaxel versus cis-vinorelbine, you know, we can spend the rest of the afternoon discussing whether cis-docetaxel was really better than cis-vinorelbine, but I think it's fair to say that it's unlikely to be worse in any setting. It's a once every 3 week regimen. Most patients will not require a port. And if you do the typical cis-vinorelbine regimen, you know, with 12 doses, It's very hard to do that without an indwelling catheter. And so it adds complexity, it adds inconvenience, and I'm not really sure that it's easier in any way. So I've been using both cis-docetaxel, which I usually use with prophylactic growth factors, or cis-gemcitabine, with which I'm very comfortable too.
Let's talk a little bit about the second paper that you referred to, looking at pemetrexed maintenance.
So that study was perhaps the one study at ASCO that has the most immediate impact in practice, because as we discussed, I think FLEX will take a little while, and it may not have an immediate impact on practice. That maintenance trial is quite relevant. That study was a phase 3 study of pemetrexate or placebo. This was a placebo-controlled trial on a 2-to-1 randomization after 4 cycles of some predefined regimens. Cis-carbo, and I think there was a non-platinum regimen included as well. And so there were, I believe, 440 patients just about in the pemetrexate arm, 220 or so in the placebo arm. And the trial was powered for progression-free survival, which in this particular setting may well be an appropriate endpoint as opposed to first-line, you know, trial, for example. They found a very significant difference in progression-free survival. In fact, it doubled. You know, it was a little less than 2 months in the placebo and a little over 4 months in the pemetrexed arm. Curves, you know, split from the very beginning. And even though the difference in median survival was not statistically significant, it trended very strongly in favor of pemetrexed. In fact, the absolute difference in median survival was nearly 3 months. And if I'm not mistaken, the p-value there was 0.06. So very strong signal that this may have had an impact on overall survival. It's an important issue, Neil, because this trial adds to the FIDES trial from ASCO 2007, which looked at more or less the same issue. And another trial, I believe from Japan, that looked at gefitinib following 3 cycles of chemo. That's a bit different from what we're discussing now. But it, in a way, it resurrects the whole maintenance question, which has been a dogma for 20 years in the treatment of this disease. There was also, and I don't know the details that well, but there was also a meta-analysis of 13 randomized trials presented at ASCO that indicated, again, a positive effect of maintenance, if you want to call it that way, on progression-free survival that was statistically significant, no significant difference in overall survival, and perhaps a detriment in terms of quality of life. And those are the issues.
You know, it's kind of interesting if you compare breast, colon, and lung in that respect, because, you know, breast, pretty much people just keep treating until the patient progresses when they have metastatic disease.
Absolutely.
Colon, they sort of do it, but then they have the old Optimox thing they bring in where they want to give people a break. And then lung, they just stop therapy.
Yes.
And sometimes I wonder, really, is there a fundamental difference in the three diseases that create this difference in the paradigm?
I think it may be the efficacy of the treatment, basically. So I think our treatments so far have had a very modest impact in the course of this illness in general. So there was very little excitement for keeping patients on chemo continuously. Now, I think this has changed. We have, in a way, optimized first-line chemo, and we continue to do that with the addition of the biologicals. We have incredibly better supportive care as far as maintaining people relatively stable throughout those initial cycles of chemo. And we have better drugs that allow us to revive some of these important questions. I am personally impressed by the results of that study. I do understand some of the issues as far as, is this really maintenance versus early initiation of second line? There are all kinds of issues with respect to definitions here. What are we really doing with these patients? But from a practical standpoint, it goes back to what you just said. This is uninterrupted treatment versus a fixed number of cycles in first line, followed by treatment only at progression. That's a very significant difference.
Any issue in terms of the fact that they didn't use BEV, and a lot of times we are using BEV, does that change anything?
I don't know that it does. This obviously will be the subject of an upcoming study. I have no doubts that this will be the next question.
You think so?
Yes.
So what do you think it'll be? Carbo, Taxol, BEV, followed by maintenance, Pemetrexa, BEV, or what?
I think if this study is sponsored by industry, as opposed to a cooperative group or NCI, I think this may end up being a carboplatin pemetrexed bevacizumab trial followed by either bevacizumab maintenance or pemetrexed and bevacizumab.
Without any taxane?
Yes. You could do this with the taxane also.
What are you doing right now in your own practice?
So I have been tempted to keep people or selected patients a little longer on chemo or to switch perhaps a bit sooner than I would otherwise. It's not too long ago, so I haven't had this opportunity come up very often, but it clearly has had an impact on the way I think about this disease. You know, the usual rule that we stop at 4 cycles, once in a blue moon we would push to 6 cycles, that is no longer as firm in my head as it used to be, so I'm sort of waiting for an opportunity to do this.
How often do the patients, I guess I'm assuming it's carbo, Taxol, BEV is your common regimen for those who are eligible. How often do people get out onto the BEV past the chemo, and how far do they get into that usually?
I think maintenance bevacizumab, even though it remains a very important question and a very practical issue for many people in practice, is used most of the time. So if a patient is able to complete 4 or 6 cycles of chemo plus bevacizumab without progression, the sense I have, not only from my practice but from others, is that the vast majority of those patients will continue on maintenance bevacizumab. I don't know the exact numbers, but...
No, that's what we're seeing in our patterns of care study. And I guess the question is, I mean, would it then make sense to think about bringing in Pemetrexa on top of the BEV?
That's what the question is about, yes. And it's interesting because these are two... Well, we know the data for maintenance bevacizumab. But Pemetrexa happens to be a drug that really lends itself to prolonged, sustained maintenance treatment, which most cytotoxic drugs are not quite appropriate.
What about the upfront combination of carbo, pemetrexate, and BEV?
So there's a study from Rush from Chicago showing excellent results. I don't know exactly the numbers, but it's a relatively well-tolerated combination. I have used it myself in certain patients that I wanted, for whatever reason, to avoid a taxane, and it's easy. And I have used that also in the salvage setting. You know, we have this, again, this principle, if you will, that we don't use combination regimens in the second line setting, which, believe me, it's probably appropriate for the vast majority of patients. But like any other rule, you know, there are exceptions, and the patient in front of you may be an exception. So I have used combination regimens in the second line. And if I have to do that, I will use carboplatin pemetrexed and sometimes add bevacizumab if that did not happen in the first-line setting.
Now, you also mentioned the JCO paper by Scagliotti and the editorial by Einhorn about the paper looking at GEM or pemetrexed adenocarcinoma, squamous carcinoma. Can you kind of go through that?
Sure. So even before we go into the Scagliotti paper, in this trial that we just discussed, the maintenance trial, they also looked at the results by histology. And sure enough, there was no difference whatsoever in patients with squamous cell carcinoma, no benefit for pemetrexed, and the benefit was restricted to patients with adenocarcinoma or large cell histology. So this was one of the studies that pointed out to a potential difference in efficacy by histology. The pivotal study that led to the approval of pemetrexed, the Nasser-Hanna trial, looking at pemetrexed versus docetaxel, was also analyzed, obviously retrospectively, by histology, and they saw the same thing. Even though the efficacy parameters were identical between the two drugs in the overall population, when they looked at adenocarcinoma patients, there seemed to be a benefit in favor of pemetrexed versus docetaxel, and the opposite was true for squamous cell carcinoma patients. This is, again, another huge dogma that has been prevalent for 20 years, meaning in the advanced setting, or even in the earlier stage setting, we never differentiated treatment regimens by histology. It wasn't that relevant. And now this is beginning to come down, and it appears that some drugs have different efficacy depending on the histology. So the Scagliotti paper
was... Can you just draw out, though, the basic science issue there in terms of what the explanation might be? TS or something?
Yeah, so I think this remains to be shown in a more conclusive way, but it appears that, you know, TS being the main target enzyme for pemetrexed, it appears that it's overexpressed in squamous cell carcinomas as opposed to adenocarcinomas versus large cell carcinomas. And this may very well be the case. This may, however, be just a phenotypic expression of a more fundamental molecular difference between adenocarcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. And there's a lot of work being done with pharmacogenomics. And we know, for example, work from Europe and work from Moffitt on ERCC1 and platinum. We know RM1 and gemcitabine. So there's a lot that comes together when we talk about histology, because histology is really just the tip of the iceberg. There's a reason why tumors will eventually lead to that phenotypic expression under the microscope versus a different one, and that's where we're going. So the Scagliotti trial was a very large study that looked at cisgemcitabine versus cispemetrexed. They saw, again, no significant differences in any of the efficacy parameters. However, in a predefined analysis, patients with adenocarcinoma had a better survival on cispemetrexed compared to cisgemcitabine. The difference in median survival was 2 months, absolute difference. And conversely, in squamous cell carcinoma patients, cisgemcitabine seemed to be better than cispemetrexed, although that difference was not statistically significant, but the trend was pretty obvious. So now we have 3 studies with pemetrexed that appear to show that this drug has a preferential activity in adenocarcinoma or large cell carcinoma patients as opposed to squamous cell patients. And should this influence practice? I think it should. I think it should. Have I begun to do that in my clinical practice? Not quite yet. Again, this is all beginning to be absorbed, I think, by clinicians. But in the next few months, it will be pretty relevant, I believe.
So give me an example about what a case would be where you maybe do something different today than you would have done a year ago because of these data.
So if you have a patient in the first-line setting who has adenocarcinoma or a large cell carcinoma, and your first-line regimen of choice happens to be cisgemcitabine, I would rethink that choice. The issue here is that we don't have the data for taxanes, which here in the United States happen to be the most popular choice for first line.
Also Bev.
Or Bev. We'll get to the Bev issue with histology in just a second. But just for the chemo alone, and then in the second line setting, you know, if you're dealing with a patient who has squamous cell carcinoma and needs second line intervention, and you typically use pemetrexed, you might want to choose a different strategy in that setting. And that's when pemetrexed and bevacizumab sort of come together. So it's not just in the maintenance issue. I think the two have a lot in common as far as maintenance, as we discussed. But as far as histological subtypes, we have these two drugs that appear to be partners, and also in terms of preferential activity. It's a little different for bevacizumab because nobody says that bevacizumab is not active or it's less active in squamous cell carcinoma patients. It's a tolerance issue. It's a toxicity issue. Here, we're saying pemetrexed seems to be less active in squamous cell patients.
What's happening in terms of locally advanced disease, and particularly the question of integrating biologics into chemo radiation therapy?
So we're all very hesitant, beginning perhaps with the first group of biologicals, the EGFR TKIs. So we have the SWOG study that, to me, was a strong reminder of how we can't use intuition as we treat patients with lung cancer that showed a detriment for the use of gefitinib after chemo and radiation and consolidation docetaxel. We actually in CALGB have just opened a study looking at poor risk patients. This is, again, a neglected subset of stage 3 patients. If you look at all of the stage 3 literature, it is restricted essentially to patients with performance status 0 to 1 and no weight loss or no significant weight loss, less than 5%. Well, unfortunately, that's not our practice. That's not anybody's practice. So we have this enormous group of patients out there that don't really fit the eligibility for the major clinical trials that have more or less led to where we are today as far as combined modality therapy. So we are beginning a study of induction chemo using carboplatin, arguably a more tolerable taxane for patients who are more susceptible to toxicity issues, followed by radiation and erlotinib. And the erlotinib is used only for the duration of the radiation. There's no maintenance erlotinib. And that's independent of clinical or molecular predictors. So this is a pure radiosensitizing question. Trying to come up with a regimen for patients that are not felt to be good candidates for combined chemo and radiation. There's a precedent for that. It was a CLGB trial using gefitinib that showed promising results in a very small number of patients, also with performance status 2. As far as bevacizumab in the stage 3 arena, again, only I hear a strong caution, TE fistulas, being seen in patients treated with chemo and radiation and bevacizumab. There's one trial moving forward at UNC by Mark Sosinski, and they have so far not seen prohibitive toxicities. Other trials have closed because of an unacceptable number of lethal toxicities. So I think it will be a while before we know how to incorporate at least bevacizumab. I'm not referring to all of the other anti-VEGF inhibitors. And as far as cetuximab, that's probably the most promising agent in the setting. We have the head and neck cancer data. So that, to me, is a paradigm trial. So we have the RTOG study that looked at chemo and radiation with cetuximab. That trial led to the best median survival ever seen in any RTOG trial in the past decade. Obviously, there may be a little bit of patient selection there, but it's very encouraging. And then we had the CLGB study using a different chemo regimen, carbopemetrexid with cetuximab, and the results of that trial as far as efficacy are still pending.
Yeah, well, I'm such an interesting life. Yesterday, yeah. I interviewed Rakesh Jain, from Harvard, and talking about his work, trying to unravel what goes on with bevacizumab and radiation therapy. Of course, he did the classic study with Chris Wilt looking at rectal cancer where they really studied these people so carefully. But I was reading his work before the interview, and I didn't really realize that, way back in the beginning, the issue was he actually demonstrated that chemo really didn't get into the tumors that well. And the whole concept of the, disordered blood supply and trying to, sort of make a lead to better oxygenation. And so, I guess it wouldn't be too illogical to think that if you threw in bevacizumab with radiation therapy, maybe what you would see would be a lot of anti-tumor effect. And maybe these fistulas or things that are happening. I've talked to the radiation oncologists also, and they say, well, you see this when you have tumor response. Is that your take on what might be going on here with the radiation and the biologics?
I think it may very well be the case. I think it's analogous to the discussion of cavitation leading to pulmonary hemorrhage in squamous cell carcinoma patients. Is this a manifestation of a brisk, response? It could very well be. But it does pose some
practical
pretty challenging
questions.
Exactly issues on the practical standpoint.